I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in anticipation of Indy Pride Fest next week, we're going to talk about the history of the LGBTQ communities here in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. My guests are Dan Shockley from the Indiana Historical Society, Rebecca Schrum from IUPUI, and Leah Namias with Indiana Humanities. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We've got a special No Limits today. In anticipation of Indy Pride Fest next week, we're going to talk today about the history of the LGBTQ communities here in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. A lot of activities designed to illuminate that history that we're going to be discussing. If you want to join this conversation, and I would encourage you to do so, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dan Shockley from the Indiana Historical Society, Rebecca Schrum from IUPUI, and Leah Namias with Indiana Humanities. Welcome to all of you. And I guess in the case of Dan and Leah, it's welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. So before we dive into the larger and sort of more fascinating subject of this history, we ought to talk about the activities that are coming up, deal with some of the logistics. I'll start with Leah on that one.
So, yeah, we're excited to be here to talk about, you know, the peg for the segment is that for the sixth year in a row, Indiana Humanities is doing our annual historic bar crawl, which we do in partnership with Indiana Historical Society. And this year's theme is Out in Indy, Dragging Indianapolis's LGBTQ History Out of the Closet. So we're really excited to tell stories about the gay community here in Indianapolis from about the late 70s into the early 90s, which, as we might get into, is a really transformative period for the LGBT community here in Indianapolis. So that's on June 20th, just while we're getting all the details out of the way. And you can visit indianahumanities.org to purchase tickets and learn more about that event.
What sorts of things are going to be part of that event?
Well, it's pretty fun. So I'll start and then maybe Dan can weigh in a little bit. So we, over the course of the evening, we will start out at Greg's here kind of on the Old North Side off of 16th Street. And then you'll be working in groups to visit five other locations over the course of the night. At each location, you will get a signature cocktail. We also have beer provided by Sun King. And you'll see a scene performed by actors from the Indiana Historical Society. And it's a real scene from Indianapolis history. We do a lot of research, and Rebecca can talk more about the research that was done for this year's bar crawl. So these are not just generic stories. These are real stories of things that happened in Indianapolis. And then you have a chance to interact with the characters, have a little bit more to eat, a little bit more to drink, and then you visit the next stop. So it's a pretty fun night.
And Dan, what are some of these scenes?
Well, some of them are going to be surprises, but okay. A couple of them I can talk about today are the Bag Ladies. The Bag Ladies in Indianapolis have been an organization here in town since 1981. They're, I believe, the longest continuously operating HIV fundraising organization in the country. And we're going to be showcasing kind of their story. We're going to anchor it in about 1985 with a couple characters and an actual tour around part of the city. And then we also have a recreation of preparation for getting ready for the first Pride on the Circle in 1990. And you know, you think of Pride and how exciting that is, but there's also the aspects of fear of protesters and what if my picture is taken and put in the newspaper? What if my family finds out I'm gay? Or what if I lose my job? Those were real concerns then and for some still today concerns.
Yeah, I'm thinking, and Rebecca, you can address this, but, I would think part of the fascination of doing this is so much of this has been hidden history. that it is stuff that is had to be uncovered. I mean, there's a reason that the, you know, the sort of quaint allusion that they would refer to this in earlier times is the love that dare not speak its name. You know, that sort of thing was undercover. So could you talk a little bit about how you began to pull this hidden history to the surface?
Sure. We're at the point now where in Indianapolis we finally have enough of these sources available for us to begin to really be able to tell that, these stories. And that's because of major collecting initiatives that have taken place in the very recent past. The Indiana Historical Society has both a major oral history project, which is collecting voices from the LGBT past in Indiana, and also a major archival collection initiative, which was able to get the papers that were originally collected by a man named Michael Bohr here in the city, who really heroically, on his own for decades, saved every single edition of the weekly local gay newspapers and magazines and kept them safe for decades until they were able to be housed and collected by the Indiana Historical Society. And those were the records that my students made the most use of. Also, in the last 3 or 4 years, Indiana Landmarks undertook a major initiative to document the buildings associated with the LGBT history of Indianapolis. And like the paper records, these buildings are often not remembered as having an association with this particular past. So it was really important to begin to collect those stories as well.
How did you settle on the period from the late 1970s forward?
So I can talk a little bit about this, but I think Rebecca should also weigh in. So that is a period where there's just a lot of change happening. And Rebecca can talk in a minute about a really galvanizing event here locally in 1977 when Anita Bryant came to town for the Rally for Decency. This was a kind of an anti-ERA, anti-LGBT rights rally. And that was a catalytic moment for the local gay community to kind of come out of the closet to form some sort of counter-protest. And, you know, of course, the context before that was Stonewall in 1969 in New York City and the first Pride celebration in 1970, the year after in New York City. And then, you know, we kind of brought the period, you know, so there's just a lot happening in the 80s. Another big part of that story, a reason that lots of folks start to get organized, like the Bag Ladies, is the arrival of HIV and AIDS, which is a crisis. And so there's a lot of organizing to respond to that crisis. And then I think into the, we thought about coming a little bit more recent, but there were so many potential stories to tell. We kind of said it's a really neat time period, kind of framed nicely from the late 70s into the early 90s. To kind of look intensely at this period of change.
Rebecca, I think Leah cued you up there, though.
Well, so Stonewall is really an important moment here in this history in 1969. And after Stonewall in 1970, you have the first public pride movements, celebrations in some of the, I think about 4 major cities across the country. And then in Indianapolis, Pride begins to be celebrated around 1980, but it's celebrated privately. And another example, the newspapers that my students were looking at, we start looking at them in the 1970s because that's when they emerge. So before Stonewall, much of this was really private and not publicly available. You know, even in the gay community, these things were not publicly distributed. So this is just a real turning point in the history.
We've gotten an email question from a listener, and if you want to join this conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or do what a listener named Jordan has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jordan writes, have you seen the gay community or the acceptance of the gay community change over the years? Dan, everybody's pointing at you, so I guess
sure.
That means you're the one designated to answer.
Well, and I'm a member of the community. It absolutely has changed over the years and continues to change. Part of the reason why we chose this time period to tell these stories is because, you know, you can jokingly say gay people didn't exist before 1969 with Stonewall. But the truth is they did.
A lot of Indiana icons would disagree with
exactly.
you.
Exactly. But yeah. A lot of people, especially private people, would have their letters or diaries burned right. by their families once they passed away in order to keep that secret within the family. So there aren't tons of archival material from before that time. And now we're in a time where, you know, the gay bars are disappearing. because of acceptance, which is wonderful. Acceptance is wonderful. My partner and I can go pretty much anywhere we want. We can't act, you know, we can't hold hands everywhere we want to go. Mm-hmm. We can't kiss everywhere we want to go, like a lot of people. But the gay bars are disappearing in part because we can go to this restaurant or that bar and feel comfortable.
Do you worry a bit? Because I know that's always part of the worry that assimilation leads to lack of identity.
Absolutely, it does. And I think that, you know, the new generations of LGBTQ people don't always have a handle on what the elders of the past went through to get to where we are today.
So one of the other changes, and I think this is really funny because, you know, the students that Rebecca was working with to do this research are all like mid-20s or younger. And so one of the things they kept encountering in their research were personal ads. And this was kind of a foreign concept, right? Because mm-hmm. in the age of Tinder and Grindr and all the, you know, in addition to gay bars closing because of acceptance, the way people meet other people has changed, you know. And so gay bars, which have been a really important place, a location, a sort of refuge and safe place and community in the LGBT community, you know, has changed, but it was also interesting. I know when your students were kind of, Rebecca, did you have to explain like what a personal ad was and how it worked? Because they just couldn't imagine that sort of like way of meeting people.
You know, honestly, I went through some of the editions of the newspapers before my students did, and I sort of paged past them quickly because, you know, I'm in my 40s and I remember these from being younger and enjoying reading them, certainly. And so I didn't pay much attention to them, and I kind of thought my students wouldn't either. And the first night that we came together as a class and they had been through a bunch of these editions at that point, they really wanted to talk about them. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, but I didn't expect them to be quite such an interesting point for the students. But they really, you know, hadn't thought about much about what it was like to live in an era before digital technologies. And they were really struck not only through the personal ads, but in lots of different layered ways of how the newspapers really supported and fostered the LGBT community in Indianapolis in the 1970s and the 1980s. One example that really has stuck with me was in 1987, several of the gay bars in town started putting out small boxes in the bars where people could put anonymous questions they had about AIDS, mm-hmm. things they were scared about or worried about or afraid to ask anybody else. And, you know, now if you have that kind of question, you just type it into Google.
You go online, yeah.
And there's no it's a very simple process, right? And so what happened was that people could put these anonymous questions in these boxes, and then the newspapers had experts who answered them, and they printed the answers in the newspaper to close up that circle and get those questions answered. And so in really important ways, these magazines served such an important set of linkages for this community.
How difficult was it for them, Rebecca, to, you know, we've talked about how different an era it was in the 1970s. And the example that comes to my mind is that the person who stopped the second assassination attempt on Gerald Ford was a gay man, a veteran. And a couple of things that became sort of a journalism ethics test case, because as a result of that, he apparently was out with his community, but not with his family and a lot of other people. That was one issue, that he was outed to the entire nation as part of it. The other was that because at that time, and maybe still in some segments of society today, the notion that a gay man could be heroic challenged our conceptions, and you could tell that the news accounts just did not know how to deal with that. Rebecca, how much have we seen that change over time, and how much did that confound your students?
There's a sort of famous saying among historians that the past is a foreign country, mm-hmm. which I really like, and because it's completely true. And I think it's one of my challenges always as a teacher to help students begin to understand that they can't just sort of put themselves back in the past and imagine, you know, how they might react to something with their current mentalities, because it's not, you know, it doesn't work that way. And so I think it certainly was a challenge for them to begin to understand the risks that people were taking in the 1970s and 1980s, the risks, like Dan, you started to talk about, associated with that first Pride Festival in 1990. There were 3,000 people who came to that festival, only 50 protesters. But the protesters, the still images we have of those protests are really powerful and suggest, you know, how risky being there as a gay person was. So I think that is a challenge that we face as historians trying to understand this past.
Leah.
One of the other challenges is, like, what information was donated to an archive that was private? And how do we, if we're telling the story to the public, what's okay to say privately? So journalists have that question. Historians have that question with oral histories and things like that. So we are telling a story of a Quaker lesbian wedding in the 1980s. And we knew that it happened. But the women, the story that we had, the historical sources didn't name the women because they wanted to be private. So we had to make, you know, that choice to not out those women, even though we wanted to tell that story.
If you're just joining us, in anticipation of Indy Pride Fest next week, we're talking about the history of the LGBTQ communities here in Indianapolis and central Indiana. My guests are Dan Shockley from the Indiana Historical Society, Rebecca Schrum from IUPUI, and Leah Namias from Indiana Humanities. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the history of the LGBTQ communities here in Indianapolis and central Indiana in anticipation both of Indy Pride Fest next week and some cool events that Indiana Humanities and the Indiana Historical Society, with cooperation of IUPUI, are doing to mark kind of the occasion and illuminate this part of our city and state's history. My guests are Dan Shockley from the Indiana Historical Society, Rebecca Schrum from IUPUI, and Leah Namias with Indiana Humanities. So we've talked about sort of why we chose this period. Can we talk about what some of the hinge points, the seminal moments have been in that history along the way? We've alluded to a couple of them, but we probably, let's try to take people back into a different world and a different time, the foreign country that the past is, that Rebecca referred to. Let's start with the whole Anita Bryant thing, because that seems to be the starting point for the story you're trying to tell here. Dan?
Well, Anita Bryant was the spokesperson for the Florida Orange Growers Association and a Christian singer, and took it upon herself to become very outspoken against the LGBT community, or homosexuals is probably what she would have said at that time. And as anybody thinks of Anita Bryant, often the pie in the face that she received at a press conference comes to mind. And as we were putting together scenes, we thought, oh, if that had only happened here, what a perfect scene that would have been for the bar crawl. But that wasn't here.
And it's hard, to capture, because for those of us who are of a certain vintage, you know, you say she was a spokesperson for, you know, the Florida Orange Growers. She was inescapable on television from the late 60s all the way through the mid-70s, Leah.
Well, and from what I understand, there was kind of a national tour that she and Jerry Falwell, who had founded the Moral Majority, were doing. And they worked with an Indiana state representative named Dan Boies, which is one of those names you can't believe is involved in this story, to plan an event that would have been at the Pepsi Coliseum or the State Fairgrounds in 1977. And I think Rebecca might be able to provide some more insight, but everything that we've been told is this was the moment when the local community said, we have to be some sort of countervailing voice to this event, and we want to organize and be there as some sort of counter-protest to this rally for decency.
Rebecca.
Yeah, and Anita had a real sense of how to, I think, bring conservative people together against LGBT rights. The organization that she founded was called Save Our Children. Mm-hmm. And she was, you know, like you said, a prolific spokesperson along several different crusades during this time period. But she came to Indianapolis in 1977 for an event called the Rally for Decency, another loaded term. When we started reading about this time period in Indianapolis's LGBT history, one of the things that came out from several voices was that this moment when there was this strong anti-gay presence in the city really was a coalescing moment for LGBT activists or people who became activists, because this moment really set them on fire to stand up and say that they were here too and that their rights were as important as anybody else's. So it was a really important catalyst in the LGBT movement in the city.
What were the linkages? Because obviously this is the same time that that Phyllis Schlafly was organizing to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment. There was an awful lot of pushback about, you know, and always trying to make, you know, society more inclusive.
Sure. The 1960s and 70s saw movement along lots of different vectors, as you've talked about. So feminist movement, anti-war movement, LGBT movement, all kinds of ways in which progressives were trying to move our society towards a more just and fair existence, I think. So what happened, not surprisingly, and this happens, you know, throughout history, when one side pushes forward, an opposing side pushes back. And that's exactly what happened here. So then conservative movements, including Phyllis Schlafly and Anita Bryant and lots of other folks, lots of people point to the election of Ronald Reagan here as a culminating point in the conservative movement during this period, sought to push those movements backwards.
And I think rhetorically, you know, what they might have in common is also this sense of we have to defend the family or we have to defend children. And so both like feminists are a threat to that as well as gay people.
We are talking about the history of the LGBTQ communities here in Indianapolis and central Indiana today on No Limits, in anticipation of Indy Pride Fest next week and some cool events that the Indiana Historical Society and Indiana Humanities are doing to illuminate this period in our history. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So I want to start, I have a larger question. What I'm asking, Rebecca, since you had people, I work with students too. We just did a documentary on Richard Lugar's career that appeared here on WFYI. And, you know, in terms of, I've made the joke that that for them, studying the creation of UNIGOV here in the community was like, you know, learning about Hannibal crossing the Alps, that the same, you know, they seemed to fit into the same period before they came. What was, because these folks, the folks who were doing this research, a lot of what you were studying happened well before they were born. What were the things that most surprised them that came out of the research that they were most fascinated by?
I think they found they again were mostly reading in these weekly magazines and newspapers. And I think they found many elements of what they discovered to be really amazing to them. In their lifespan, one of the defining things that happens in the 1970s and 1980s is AIDS. And in their lifespan, AIDS is a disease that people get and that people live with. Mm-hmm. And in the 1980s, AIDS was a disease that you got and that you died from. And pretty quickly. And there was so much confusion around understanding how this disease worked for so many years. And that really came out strongly in the newspapers because they would frequently publish sort of like a recent finding about something related to AIDS. And my students were looking for historical evidence. And I had to caution them very early on not to pay attention to those scientific findings because they were constantly being superseded by other scientific findings. And they weren't going to find the truth of how AIDS worked in those early attempts to understand it. So I think that they were really intrigued by how watching a disease unfold and how our nation sort of dealt with that and how much that got tied up with politics, because AIDS comes to be in the early 1980s during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, during this ascendancy of conservatism. And there's a great resistance from the government, from politicians, and from medicine to really do the research and provide the care that was desperately needed. So they saw both sort of that difficult story, but then also the really amazing story in communities around the nation. Here it was the Bag Ladies and also the Damien Center, which was founded in 1987 to provide health care and education for people living with HIV and AIDS. They were really struck by the ways in which a local community could pick up the pieces where they were being left behind and really make change. So it was eye-opening for them in lots of different ways. And I think, you know, you're right that in large part it's because of their age and that they had not seen a lot of this stuff, you know, firsthand.
Yeah, and it would be a mistake to argue that these are these are not contentious issues today, particularly
Correct.
Here in a state where, you know, we've had battles over RFRA and a constitutional proposed constitutional ban on same-sex marriage and all of that. But it was a different time then. I mean, and there were things that at least one would hope in mainstream society we would not be hearing. Mainstream discussions, you know, HIV and AIDS at that time fairly routinely were referred to as the gay plague. And, you know, there would be arguments advanced that, you know, that this was some form of divine retribution.
Right.
That, you know, the argument kind of fell apart when they realized that straight people
right.
could be infected too. Well, but yeah.
And it was originally, or one of the original names before HIV/AIDS, before it was called HIV/AIDS, was gay cancer.
Right.
Yeah.
And I came out in 1985 to my parents, and AIDS began, you know, just a few years before that. So I was lucky enough to be in a generation where I could learn some things about it before I started dating. But that wasn't true for many people. And so early on, you know, I was a member of the men's chorus when it first started. We lost countless members. I was a member of the Indianapolis community theater community. I couldn't begin to name the number of people that I personally knew that I lost to HIV.
One of the other things that I think is interesting, and when you think about a change, is that recently, you know, the fight and for rights has been around marriage as a symbol of equality and kind of a really wholesome image of gay life, right? And it's a really important right, and we've spent a lot of time. But, you know, the arguments that really started to get articulated for gay marriage within the gay community were in response to AIDS as well. It was like, I want visiting rights for my partner or, you know, and I want the right to decide what happens to their property if they die. And that's a change, too, because there had been a complicated relationship with the idea of marriage and monogamy as kind of a straight institution that maybe part of some people in the gay community felt like, you know, we're kind of an example of a different way of living your life and different attitudes about that. But that case for marriage really starts to come out of the AIDS crisis. And I just think it reiterates the idea that you can't overstate how significant AIDS was and part of, you know, why so much is happening in the 1980s, why so much organizing is happening, institutions being founded, and efforts to communicate are in part because AIDS is the reason.
So I sort of deviated from my own line of questioning when I wanted to talk about other hinge points and seminal moments. We talked about Anita Bryant and what a catalyst she was. What are some of the other big moments along the way? Dan, I'll start with you.
Well, I think a big moment happened this week with the same-sex wedding cake with the Supreme Court. So those kinds of milestones have been happening all along.
Although that one's more deferred. I've read the ruling, and it is about the narrowest possible ruling there could be.
It is. But as a blanket, it's, you know, that's not a baker I would go to. And I feel it's important to know throughout our history is know who your friends are, know who your foes are. And that has shown itself many times over the years.
So certainly locally, you know, in 2014, Indiana, Hoosiers who are LGBT gain the right to wed. And that's about 6 to 9 months before the national Supreme Court case legalizes it. And so I would say that a lot of that history isn't on the time period that we're talking about on our historic bar crawl this year. But, you know, that's certainly a really important moment. Maybe Dan can talk a little bit about what it was like to kind of be watching that change happen in real time.
Well, I never thought I'd see it, first of all. Mm-hmm. You know, when you grow up and you plan your dream wedding, that's not something that LGBT kids could do because it was just never going to be a possibility. So the fact that, you know, the kids growing up now who identify as LGBT can plan their dream wedding in their mind their whole life is, to me, I think, a beautiful thing.
In 1990, the first, you know, Circle City celebration pride that's public, I think, is really significant. So the year before, there had been a public celebration at the Indiana Athletic Complex or Sports Complex. I can't remember the exact name of it. So that was the first public one, but it was indoors. And as Rebecca mentioned earlier, throughout the 1980s, there had been kind of private celebrations inside, you know, hotels or bars, but coming out visibly in this really important symbolic space. I mean, the most important claim you can make on your right to be a member of this community in Indiana is to do it at the Circle. So that's another really important moment that we wanted to interpret on the bar crawl, because we say this is a real turning point. And of course, 3,000 people is a lot of people in 1990. You know, now Pride is 100,000 people that come out. So also looking at, you know, over 30 years, that change is really remarkable. And it's exciting to think about where we might be in 30 years.
How did this begin to crystallize into a movement? I mean, obviously there are ways, you know, moments when outrage, you know, to use the example of Anita Bryant, that very easily, though, could have just been a temporary flash. We see that an awful lot in history where people are upset about a particular person or event. But you're right. There was a tremendous amount of organization that began occurring out of that. Who were some of the key players in that? And, you know, how did that process unfold? Everybody's looking at you, Rebecca, so I guess you're the one
who's... That's why we brought a historian.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I think, you know, in general, what made some of these moments stick, which is what we're talking about, right, so that they actually transfer into some change, is that people who were interested in different causes were coming forward at the same time, so that people didn't feel like they were entirely alone by advocating an agenda that was trying to forward feminist movement or African-American civil rights or LGBT rights, so that there were more players on the stage to sort of move things forward. And I think that made a tremendous difference. And then also, I think that the backlash is really important because it helps communities find their voices and encourages them to stand up for who they are. So there were certainly lots of individuals in Indianapolis and around the state who were doing really important work during this time period, advocating for funding for AIDS and HIV, who were working for ending discrimination in the workplace, working for marriage rights, working for all kinds of things, and that ability to sort of see themselves as part of a greater whole, not only within this movement, within lots of movements, was really important.
In retrospect, though, Dan, you know, being able to look at something in hindsight always imposes a kind of order and on it. In the interest of full disclosure, I was part of that. I was the executive director of what then was the Indiana Civil Liberties Union for about 6 years, from 98 to 2004. And I remember some of those meetings and just the intensity of the debates and a lot of the vying over, you know, what priorities should be and all of that. Can you speak to the kind of chaotic nature of how that movement began to find its voice?
Well, you know, I don't truly know exactly how that happened, because it was so foreign to me that it could happen. And even within the LGBT community, you have so many, you know, each letter stands for a very different group of people, even though they have many common goals. And certainly we've seen that, you know, with the whole what's happening with the trans movement right now is that anytime you get a group of people in a room, as you well know, it is hard to find a consensus and a path forward sometimes.
And so one of the sites that we are interpreting, you know, it's a bar crawl, but also bars are really important because it's also a place where who's in and who's out. Are bisexual people welcome in our bars, our trans people welcome in our bars. Those are conversations that are happening in bars. And sometimes, you know, the answer is not always a positive one, but we know bars are really important. I would love if people could call in and tell their stories of their favorite bars or other meeting places in Indianapolis's history.
We are talking about the history of the LGBTQ communities here in Indianapolis and Central Indiana in anticipation of Indy Pride Fest next week and some cool events Indiana Humanities and the Indiana Historical Society in partnership with IUPUI are doing. My guests are Dan Shockley from the Indiana Historical Society, Rebecca Schrum from IUPUI, and Leah Namias with Indiana Humanities. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the history of the LGBTQ communities here in Indianapolis and Central Indiana, really about the way a movement took shape. This is in anticipation of Indy Pride Fest next week and some really interesting events that the Indiana Historical Society and Indiana Humanities have pulled together in cooperation with IUPUI. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Dan Shockley from the Indiana Historical Society, Rebecca Schrum from IUPUI, and Leah Namias with Indiana Humanities. When we were on the break, actually, we talked about one of the big changes, which, you know, sounds like a relatively minor thing, but is not, because it does symbolize not just acceptance, but security at some level. And I don't want to rob from the power of the story, so I'm just going to toss it to Dan.
Well, you know, we were talking earlier about how the gay bars in many ways are closing because we have the ability to go almost anywhere. But the other side of that is the gay bars that are still in existence are able to be more open and literally open by removing the barriers from their windows. Most gay bars, a lot of gay bars, would have either black painted windows or they would have boards over their windows, and that was for safety. It wasn't for the privacy of what was happening in the building.
In some cases, even bars. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Bars on the windows. Yeah. It was for to keep the bullets out of the building. And one of the stories we'll be telling is of an Indianapolis bar in the early 80s who they had had to have their windows boarded up after having an issue. And they brought in scenic painters who painted beautiful murals on their boarded-up windows. But, you know, it wasn't there for beauty. It was there for safety. And English Ivy's here in town just within the past few years took down their boarded-up windows. And it looks like a whole different place.
Was there any sort of ceremony attached to that? I mean, was the significance of the moment appreciated, or was it just one of those things, we don't need this anymore?
I don't know. It happened, and I found out after it happened. So if there was something, I don't know. But then the gay community is, you know, there's no real gay newspaper anymore here in town because we have newspapers. And so we're not as segregated as we were. But that also means news doesn't travel as fast as it used to in some ways.
We've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named, I think it's Kiera. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Kiera writes, I will be bringing some Indiana Pride to San Francisco to be on a panel to talk about being GLBT in trucking. Then there will be an interview for YouTube, and then I will be in the San Francisco Pride Parade. At some level, you know, I mean, and I hope I'm interpreting this right, but in addition to being just a political statement now to some degree. These also have become networking events, it sounds like, that there is, and that is a level of acceptance and assimilation that would have been not easily imaginable 30 years ago.
It's also fascinating that, you know, now we can start to discover the histories that of workplaces, right? Of how LGBT people find each other, how they might concentrate in certain kinds. Maybe, I mean, I'm assuming from the comment, maybe that this is a really common thing, that the trucking is significant in some way. And so we're just now, this is such an exciting moment in kind of the historiography of the gay community to be able to find these stories, to do oral histories. I hope that's a story that we can continue to learn more about, because we just don't know. And it's a big moment of change kind of in how we tell or look back at this history.
And I guess my point with that also was at some level, it wasn't just, the private lives, your intimate relationships that were driven underground. A lot of these other associations that help people move along through and even forward in life were denied to LGBTQ citizens during that era because they couldn't acknowledge who they were. Dan.
Yeah, that's true. I, you know, years ago when I first came out, I dated a teacher. And he, with her permission, had a fake girlfriend for school functions because he couldn't be out as a teacher. And that was in the late 80s, early, mid-80s. So, you know, the old stereotype of florist and hairdressers for gay men, that was true to a degree because those were looked at as safe occupations. You know, if you encountered a gay florist, you wouldn't be shocked. But if you encountered a gay doctor or a gay teacher or something like that, it could be jarring to you and you would not trust that.
Well, I remember actually I was at the newspaper. It wasn't here in Indiana. A story of a teacher in Michigan who had come in rural Michigan, had been hired by the school community as the band teacher and immediately, you know, vitalized that program. Not only did they start winning state awards, regional awards, they went on and were winning national awards. And the community was so pleased with this guy that the school board decided to grant him tenure 2 years ahead of schedule, which is almost unheard of. What made it a story is then almost immediately afterwards, they started a movement to fire him because he'd gone through a commitment ceremony. You couldn't get married at the time, but a commitment ceremony with his partner I think it was the Meyer Gardens in Grand Rapids or someplace like that. And, you know, all the guy had accomplished was wiped away simply because of that. And it ripped the community apart.
Well, and that story also makes me think about the exciting work that can be done to understand LGBT history in small towns and in rural areas. And I know as part of their collecting initiative with Indiana Landmarks and the Historical Society is, you know, there are reasons why gay communities form in cities because people leave maybe small towns. But there are also many people who live their entire lives and in small towns and rural areas. And that's another area to learn more about.
We are talking about the history of the LGBTQ communities here in Indianapolis and central Indiana today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Dennis has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been in a straight marriage for 46 years, and the history of marriage in America today is the divorce rate or separation rate is 54% to 56%. Has anybody collected data on non-straight relationships? It can't be any worse than what our data is. And I know there's only been 2 or 3 years of marriages, but there's got to be data on relationships. Do you have any data to support that?
Well, I'll defer, but I guess I would point something out. Based on my experience at the ACLU, and my attorneys would have argued that there were gay divorces long before there was gay marriage, that they had to, that the process was very, very complicated. And among other things, legalizing this created a much more simple pathway. But I'll see if there is any evidence. Thanks very much for the call and the question,
Dennis. I think that would be a question a social scientist would have to answer, because that's probably who's doing the research on this. Unfortunately, none of us are the right folks for that question.
And I don't know any data, but I have always said that gay couples don't have to get married, where there are sometimes heterosexual couples who, for one reason or another, have to get married. That doesn't seem to happen as much in the gay community.
Not as many pregnancies.
Not as many. Okay. Not as many unwanted pregnancies.
Not as many shotgun weddings.
Many.
Fathers standing at the door and all of that.
Exactly.
Hopefully those are declining across the board.
We are talking about the history of the LGBTQ communities here in Indianapolis and in central Indiana. Kira, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Certainly. Are you the same one who sent us the Facebook message?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Okay, want to amplify your point, please.
So just in 18 years, I've seen a lot of change. Even I work for a trucking company, and, you know, here recently they've become very GLBT friendly. And so much so that I see quite a few trans truck drivers. You know, and they're open about it, which is wonderful. And I'm actually, they're letting me go out to San Francisco to talk about trucking and being transgender.
Mm-hmm. That's so amazing. That sounds like it's going to be an amazing time when you're in San Francisco, because that is still kind of the mothership of
big pride. I have never been there.
I think you'll have a great time. Dan, would you say the same?
Yeah, you'll love it.
Yeah. Just wear comfortable walking shoes, because the hills can be brutal. But
I've heard that.
Thanks very much for the call, Kira.
Thank you so much.
Certainly.
That was great.
John, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I wanted to recall actually a bit of a striking anecdote about the first time we celebrated Gay Pride in the Circle. I was a participant in the Gay Pride that year, and I recall Chris Gonzalez, who was the founder of the Indiana Youth Group, was
Franklin College graduate,
that was going to be the inaugural performance of the men's chorus in the Circle that day as well, and we had caught wind that the two busloads of rather fervent believers from the Baptist Temple were on their way downtown in two busloads with Bibles and bats to make sure we were taken off the Circle quite brutally. And Chris, they were going to park their buses next to the old LS Airs building there at Meridian in Washington. And Chris, if anybody knew him, he was only like 5'6" and quite a diminutive young man, but he was full of assertion that day, and he was marching towards LS Airs to stop them from ruining our day. And what was hilarious is as they approached us, as the members got off the bus and came towards us, Michael Hayden, who was the director of the men's chorus, very wisely said he saw the group coming towards us, and he saw what was happening, and Michael immediately asked the men's chorus to sing the national anthem. And the great thing was is that those four fervent Christians had no idea what to do, because they knew they had to stop and put their hand over their hearts to acknowledge the anthem, which actually gave us adequate time for the police to arrive and to quell, you know, the oncoming people who were going to come and beat us up in the Circle. So it was quite an experience to see Chris, you know, very courageously and almost single-handedly want to stop these people. And the men's chorus actually played a key part in keeping something turning very ugly that day from being turned into quite a comic experience, and allowed us to continue safely on that day.
John, since you were actually part of the history that we were talking about here,
I was very proud to be a part of it. Yes,
could you talk about the spirit of that moment, what it was like to be there?
You know, we were, you know, there were so many of us, and I was in a, you know, in a relatively minor leadership position in the GLBT community in those days. And I helped, you know, with the formation of the Men's Chorus and a couple other things. But the thing that was very, very powerful for us is that even though we knew we deserved to be there in the circle, and as your participants talked about, you know, that is a symbolic place to say to the community that we're here and that we have a right to exist. I don't think there was anybody in the crowd that day, and it was a small but very, you know, very courageous crowd, that wasn't at least a little scared of what the implications of our personal safety, as they mentioned, you know, with the bars having the windows covered and stuff. For us, we were out in the open, and it was terrifying and exhilarating at the same time that we actually were going to be able to survive that day and successfully survive, you know, even an onslaught by, you know, some people who intended us harm on the first time that we were going to be in that circle.
Are you surprised to see the changes? I mean, that, you know, in some ways, 28 years seems like a long time, but in the scope of human history, that's the blink of an eye.
It sure is. I mean, I think when some of your observations earlier about that the AIDS crisis certainly helped galvanize the community, because as one of your speakers talked about, you know, I probably lost more than half of my friends, you know, through AIDS. And you get a sense, you know, that these are the times in your life, you know, when you're 20s, 30s, and 40s, you know, when you're not supposed to be losing your friends at that time of your life, and friends, you know, that had been you know, completely pushed away from their families and their loved ones, and you know, and literally had, you know, the in the hospitals where they had the plates pushed under the door because nurses and doctors wouldn't even come in the room. So we had this sense of incredible urgency about taking care of one another. And so I think that's what helped galvanize the community that we don't deserve this treatment, and we're going to, you know, try and fight very, very diligently to make sure there's some dignity left, particularly for those who were, you know, who were dying very, very from diagnosis to death. You know, in those days was 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, it created a tremendous sense of urgency for us to come together as a community. And as you said, you know, when you have such a diverse community of GLBT, all with their own needs and agendas and desires, to get in a room and say, you know, despite our individual preferences, we've got to get a common message and a common strategy here, you know, to make the overall effort, you know, one of, you know, trying to get some sense of, yeah, Maslow's pyramid, you know, you got to take care of safety issues first, but then let's move up the ladder, you know, to a sense of belonging and a sense of community and hopefully to a sense of, you know, dignity and respect.
Thanks very much for calling in and sharing your story, John. It's good to hear from someone who was there.
My pleasure. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So we're getting close on time here. We're running up right on the end of the program. Probably ought to talk a little bit more about these events, how people can plug into them if they wish.
Hope that you'll come join us on our bar crawl on Wednesday, June 20th. So you can purchase tickets at indianahumanities.org. You can find more information out about what's available. Those are still available, and we would love to have you. And frankly, it's designed to be fun, interactive, and for you to share your story. And hopefully you might learn something new, whether you're straight or gay. And we'd love to have you. We promise we'll feed and water you quite well.
What is the cost?
It's $60, which includes all of your food and drinks at six stops.
At six stops?
Yeah, so you will get a taxi home, I hope.
You can get pretty loaded.
You can.
six stops. Okay. Well, that might not be the most uplifting word, but it will have to be the last word here.
Depends on your sense of fun, I suppose.
Yes. I would like to thank my guest, Dan Shockley, from the Indiana Historical Society, Rebecca Schrum from IUPUI, and Leah Namias with Indiana Humanities for what has been an illuminating conversation about a part of history that we don't talk enough about. I also like to thank our listeners for some great questions and for some great stories. It's fun doing talk radio for the smartest audience around. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.